Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A California lawmaker has an interesting idea to curb the rise of anti-LGBTQ plus legislation across the country in recent years. According to the Human Rights Campaign, more than 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills have been introduced in state legislatures, which is a record by the nonprofit's count. What this lawmaker is proposing is kind of an about-face from how the Golden State currently responds to laws that conflict with state values. For several years, a California law actually banned state-funded travel to states with anti-LGBTQ plus legislation. And California State Senate pro tempore Tony Atkins argues that this approach came with unintended consequences, further isolating LGBTQ plus members in those restrictive states. So the Democrat from San Diego authored a bill that would not only reverse that travel ban, but also launch a marketing campaign in those states to promote inclusive messaging and combat that isolation. Senate Leader Atkins joins us now about authoring SB 447, which is called the Bridge Project, and that's an acronym which stands for Building and Reinforcing Inclusive, Diverse, Gender-Supportive Equality. Senate Leader Atkins, welcome.
Thank you so much, and good morning.
Good morning. So California is bold in progressive legislation, but this bill that we're going to be talking about, it's not something that we don't immediately think about, you know, funding inclusive messaging so that LGBTQ plus members in other states feel supportive. So before we dive into the details, can you just walk me through your train of thought that led you to authoring this bill?
Well, I think what we tried to do in 2016 was to call attention to an issue, which is inclusivity is important. The values are about inclusivity are important. And so we sent a message to North Carolina during the legislation on the bathroom ban, and it worked. People said, we can't support that and those values, so we're not going to come to North Carolina. But now we're at 23 states, and I think we find that it isolates us from being able to be present, be visible, and show examples of inclusivity and success. I couldn't go to most of the states I grew up in if I followed the ban and didn't use personal money. I couldn't travel there to be part of a conference to talk about research about how these bills impact us. And that's what we heard from academic institutions. We can't even travel to the states to do the research using our state money, our university dollars. And so it really limits our ability to be impactful in a broader way, and we're really isolating ourselves.
So by essentially, you know, drawing a line in the sand based on, you know, the state's values, it had this unintended consequence of, you know, limiting awareness and outreach to people who are part of that community and live in those states.
Right. I mean, I grew up in one of those states. I know what it's like to feel isolated. I know what it's like to feel like you have no support around you. And I think the ability to be there and to be present speaks volumes, because it really is personal relationships, direct communication and contact that change hearts and minds. I know that. It changed my parents. They've always been accepting, grew up in Pentecostal holiness family, but they accepted me. And I think that we could learn something from that. It is about kindness. It is about building bridges. And we can only do that if we're able to be there.
When you're talking about 2016, you're referencing AB 1887, and that was signed into law. So essentially, in response to what was happening in North Carolina, the state effectively banned any state-funded travel to states that have pieces of legislation that are considered anti-LGBTQ+.
Correct. And, you know, I do think that it did have an impact. But I think when you see that something is not exactly working the way you'd hoped, you need to pivot. You need to think of a different strategy, because the goal is to be supportive. And so I think this is a positive approach and a different approach, because I do think we need to find ways to communicate those values. And I do think there is a place for bans and boycotts. We know in our history the Great Boycott. I grew up participating in Southwest Virginia on the Great Boycott. It worked. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And you need to be prepared to alter what works and what doesn't.
The bill that you authored is titled The Bridge Project. What would this accomplish?
Well, I think what it does is it sends positive messages. I don't know if you've seen recent billboards in San Francisco, Los Angeles, that shows a picture of a great icon, Dolly Parton. I always like to reference Dolly. And it says kindness. Kindness matters. And I remember growing up and during sports events, national sports events on TV, I would see an ad about bring the world together. You may not remember the product, but I always remember, I'd like to teach the world to sing and live in perfect harmony. Those messages are positive. It's not about a politician. In fact, this bill says no elected officials, no politicians. This is nonpartisan positive messaging that we can do as part of outreach to be inclusive. And thank you for talking what BRIDGE stands for. It is inclusive. It is diverse. It is bringing people together to build bridges.
And this is part of GoBiz, which is the governor's business department, its agency. And the obviously, the mission of GoBiz is economic strategy, right? From business development to private investment to just overall economic growth. So how does the BRIDGE project fit into GoBiz's mission?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think we support tourism. We support economic advantages with other countries and in other states. And so I think it fits nicely with the message of we are a welcoming place and we will reach out to you. That's part of what GoBiz does. I'm meeting later today with a group of Japanese business associations from Northern California and Southern California. I've been to Japan. So it's no different than taking your message, your brand into other states, not into other countries, or we're doing that, but into other states.
How will this be funded?
This is set up to be a donor-funded program. The state could put money into this, but I don't think that's a reasonable proposition right now in terms of our budget. So it can take contributions and donations. And I fully believe that we will be able to do that and start a program with donor-funded contributions. Hmm.
This would also include contracting with a private nonprofit agency who would pretty much take the lead in producing these public service announcements. How will the selection process go?
Well, that's part of the legislation, and the bill is now in the Assembly. It's left the Senate. And there's recommendations to add who would oversee that. What kind of process would you have? And I do think we need a process. And there are national organizations, nonprofits, that do incredible work. So I think we would want a process of stakeholders to work with GoBiz. We've done that before in other councils and other working groups. So we're crafting that now as the bill goes through the process. But I look forward to having a process that would make it possible for stakeholders to weigh in and have some accountability.
When looking at the bill's analysis, there is no opposition on the bill. That's on record. But when you mentioned that this is going to be largely donation funded, GoBiz did indicate that it would incur annual staffing costs at roughly $500,000. Would those donations go towards the staffing costs or would that come from the state?
It could be either. I mean, that's obviously an annual negotiation around budget discussions, which, you know, we are in the middle of right now. You know, my hope is that we would be able to fund this through contributions first and foremost and go from there. Again, I'm mindful of our economic situation, but I do believe there are people who believe in this and who will contribute. And I think that could go towards some of the cost administratively.
Some may be arguing that, you know, we have civil rights issues in California. We should focus on what's happening in our state before focusing on what's happening in other states. What's your response to that?
Absolutely, and we should do it all. I don't think we should be hypocritical and think that we should export our values when we have issues here at home. The LGBTQ caucus, Plus Caucus, is supporting Pride and communities up and down the state. We've made it a priority to go to smaller communities where support is needed, where you have communities that don't exactly feel like some of us who may have bigger advantages in San Diego or the Bay Area. Not that there aren't problems there. We know there are, whether we're talking the LGBTQ plus community or the API community, where we've seen incidents of violence. We need to look within ourselves. So I think this applies very much to us, as well as to the 23 other states that we currently are not able to travel to with state funds.
Finally, Senate Leader Atkins, you have a really valuable hindsight with more than a decade in the state legislature. You were in the state assembly since 2010. You were also assembly speaker before moving over to the Senate. I mean, you've really had a front row seat to legislation and the impact that legislation can have for better or for worse. How have bills impacting the LGBTQ plus community, how has it changed since you first joined the state legislature in 2011?
A great deal. My predecessor and my mentor, Chris Kehoe, was the first chair of the newly created LGBTQ plus caucus. There's a fabulous documentary called Political Animals that former Senator Carol Migdon helped put together. And it shows the transition of what it was like to be an out LGBTQ person in the legislature 20 years ago. And we've come a long way. You see allies, our allies that are non-gay, who are doing legislation and who really take a lead. I think culture has changed. Values have been more inclusive. And so there's a lot of positive things. But we still have issues. I mean, there are issues not just towards my community. Women, what women are facing as a backlash to the Dobbs decision around the right to abortion, communities of color, Black Lives Matter, reparations, all of those issues are conversations we can have. And I've seen a lot of strides in all of those issues, but we have a ways to go. And those discussions are important. And back to the mission of SB 447, building bridges, we need to learn to dialogue together. We need to not be so polarized on all of those issues. So I think for me, it all comes together.
Senate Leader Atkins, thank you for the time.
Well, thank you so much.
And that is State Senate Pro Tempore Tony Atkins. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Owning a home has long been considered the American dream, and for many, it is the best way to build wealth for ourselves and future generations. But turning this dream into a reality has been out of reach for millions of Californians. In 2022, when home prices hit record highs and interest rates began to climb, only one in five Californians earned enough income to buy a median price home, which was $822,000, according to the California Association of Realtors. That affordability gap was even wider for Black and Latino residents. Only 1 in 10 were able to afford a median-priced home. Sacramento is considered one of the hotter housing markets in the state and is a prime example of this racial disparity. In the capital city, the Black homeownership rate is 31%. That is less than half of the white homeownership rate at over 65%. Today, we're going to take some time understanding the economic and racial wealth gap, as well as some solutions to help more people realize this American dream. I sat down with Keisha Matthews, the owner of Matthews & Company Realty Group, as well as a radio talk show host of Selling Sacramento, and Adam Briones, the CEO of California Community Builders. Key and Adam, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you for having us.
Key, I want to start with you because you've been on Insight before. When you take a look at, let's just say, the last year from June 2022 to June 2023 and how the market has changed, I mean, beyond the higher interest rates, we all know that. What else have been some of the biggest changes that you've seen?
Well, still inventory is just definitely at a stalemate. It's so tight. There are a lot of new home construction projects happening, but even those too, they are being just, you know, wrapped up so quickly. I just showed a property to a client over the weekend. It came on the market one day. The next day we went to see it, it was gone. And so, and we're talking about $500,000-$600,000 price point. So it's still, inventory is still very tight.
And there's still an appetite to
Absolutely. You wouldn't think there would be with the higher interest rates, but there are people that have just acclimated themselves, I think, to the higher interest rate, knowing that what goes up eventually must come down. I've talked to several clients who remember buying in the early 90s, and they say, oh, yeah, I bought my home at almost double-digit interest rate or, you know, 14% interest rate, and they had done it several times over, knowing that eventually rates were going to come down.
Is that how you advise people who want to break into owning a home?
Well, I can definitely say I just myself bought my second home a few months ago, so in this crazy market. And I bit the bullet knowing that. And I had to have that real conversation with myself. Keisha, if you do this, how would you advise your clients? Would you do this? If you do this, why are you doing this? And my thought process was, I'm getting the home that I love. There were two other offers, so I'm competing with this house. So I actually went a little bit above the purchase price to get the home that I love now, refinance later, and I'll be good.
What are some of the most common mistakes that people might make when it comes to deciding whether they should buy or even sell their home in this current market?
I think one of the biggest mistakes that I see most often is that people are paying attention to the messaging in the media, which pretty much are like 30-second sound bites, or on a national level when real estate is regional and local. So what's happening on a national level may not necessarily be what's happening right now locally. So it's very important to be speaking with a professional full-time who's doing things in your local region so that you have a real clear understanding of exactly what things are impacting the market.
Yeah, and we know that home ownership is one of the best ways to create wealth, and not only wealth, generational wealth, and
right,
to pass it on to younger generations. There are still a lot of barriers to get in on that. What are some of the biggest barriers for people who are economically disadvantaged?
Yeah, those barriers still exist, and it's the same big two. That's the down payment and the credit issues. And so for most people, the credit score is an easier thing to fix than the down payment. The down payment is changing. It's a moving target. As prices increase, as rates increase, it's even more tough for someone to come up with that down payment. And so with the down payment assistance programs that are available, it's really imperative that they be molded to directly target individuals who are, you know, disadvantaged or have a tougher time saving that money.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends that can afford the mortgage. Mm-hmm. It really comes down to the down payment,
yeah,
or maybe it's their credit score as
right,
well. And those
yeah,
are two huge barriers. It's not actually the mortgage,
yeah,
because rents are high as well.
Absolutely. And we use the term disadvantaged, and oftentimes that term disadvantaged is tied to Black and brown communities. But in this era that we're living in now, that applies to everyone. Especially here locally in Sacramento, the median sales price or median purchase price is about $510,000. There are not a lot of households making that kind of money to be able to afford that pricing. So if we're talking about building programs or creating down payment assistance opportunities that help those who cannot help themselves, we really are talking about every ethnicity, not just one or two.
Adam, you lead California Community Builders. Tell us more about your organization.
Sure. California Community Builders is an organization that's working to close the racial wealth gap using housing and home ownership as our primary tools. And we do research, we are advocates, and we also work on program implementation and leadership development.
What led to you to want to lead an organization like this?
Well, that's a funny story. You know, I got my start in public policy and then actually spent about 10 years after grad school working on affordable housing, finance, and development. But then really thinking about the systemic issues facing people of color in California and throughout the nation, you know, realizing that there are just some really structural issues we need to fix around housing production and access to capital and access to mortgages that have to change before we can really change the economic structures for communities of color here in the state.
What are some of the root causes that aren't part of, you know, the larger conversation when talking about buying a home?
first and foremost, we have to think about our history of discrimination in the state, going all the way back to redlining, when communities of color were excluded from home ownership, when they were kept out of the mortgage market, all the way to after redlining became illegal. Many cities and local communities instituted single-family-only development regulations. So single-family homes are obviously the most expensive type of homes you can have, and they were often put in place so that folks that couldn't afford those homes were kept out of specific communities. And so when racial discrimination became illegal, economic discrimination was used to keep black and brown folks out of certain neighborhoods. So now when we look at communities, and Key is correct, you know, this is something that impacts every community, but especially for black and Latino families that have low wealth and in high cost markets like Sacramento, the Bay Area, and Los Angeles, it is very, very difficult to attain home ownership and really start down that journey of building wealth for you and your family.
Given that your organization, the focus is closing the racial wealth gap, how do you come to understand or digest the current housing market and the challenges that face people who just want to get into owning a home?
So first, it's really, you know, two things. So one, it's the fact that we in California have created an artificial housing scarcity. So we've only built for the past 10 years about 45% of the housing that we need for all the families that want to live in our state. We're about 2 million units short. And what that means, as always, is that the folks on the lower end of the economic scale always lose out. You know, when you have wealthy people competing with lower income people, wealthy people are always going to win out in a bidding war. And then second, you know, one of the things we really need to think about is incomes. You know, what we found is that incomes have really not kept pace with housing prices. And so what we have are more and more expensive homes with incomes that don't really match that. And when you think about who is most likely to be lower income, who is most likely to be unemployed, it really is black and Latino families. And so one of the things that I think is most disconcerting recently is that as the Federal Reserve thinks about how do we lower inflation, the tool they go to most quickly is raising rates, raising interest rates. And what they know and what everyone knows is that when you raise interest rates, you're also going to be increasing unemployment. And when you increase unemployment, you're primarily talking about increasing unemployment amongst black families and other families of color. And that's really important to keep in mind.
How are interest rates tied to employment?
So as interest rates go up, you have businesses that are hiring less and firing more. They're investing less in their own infrastructure. And unfortunately, now and throughout the history of our country, black employees are the first people to be fired and the last hired. And that's also consistent with other communities of color like Latinos, immigrants, and what have you. And so as interest rates go up, certainly we do want to tame inflation, but we also do need to think about the impacts both in home buying and then the broader economy and who's really feeling that the worst. Mm.
Key, I see you nodding along as well. I mean, is that something you see firsthand?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's always, I say there's this hidden racism that still exists in our policies and foundation, especially the foundation of real estate. When you think about FHA loans, who are those that are most likely to get an FHA loan? Because it was created specifically to allow someone a step into home ownership by not putting down as much, not needing to have the high credit scores. And those individuals are the black and brown communities. So you look at just this last April, the stats for Sacramento County real estate show that almost 70% of the homes were purchased with conventional loans. Something around 14% were FHA.
So essentially, because a lot of homes get multiple offers, especially in the last few years. So would a seller look at the type of loan that is being used when choosing the best person to?
Yeah,
to,
absolutely.
To
so it's almost like an indirect.
Home.
It's like an indirect discrimination happening without them having to acknowledge it for that reason. Because on its face, you have a conventional cash is king. So cash offers are going to be accepted first, especially if they can close fast and they're netting the seller the highest. Then it's conventional because there's an assumption that if you've qualified for a conventional loan, you've got the best credit score and you're putting down more money. FHA would come under that. And so if you are a listing agent and you're showing three different offers, cash, FHA, and conventional, you're going to tell your seller, you're kind of required to tell your seller which of these is the strongest offer. So without having to discriminate directly, you are discriminating. And so I like to tell my sellers that FHA loans close just as quickly as conventional, FHA loans are just as strong as conventional, and there's actually a misconception out there that FHA loans take longer to close. And that couldn't be any further from the truth. They close in 21 days now. If you're competitive, you've got to close a loan in 21 days in the Sacramento region.
In the last couple years, I mean, home prices have just gone up exponentially in the Sacramento metro area. This was obviously during the pandemic, and then more broadly, California saw population drops. However, in Northern California, you know, Bay Area cities were seeing the biggest drops in population, and some of those people were moving more inland. They were heading east. Mm-hmm. And some cities like Roseville, for example, they saw a 4.3% increase.
Yeah.
How do you think that has impacted first-time home buyers in the Sacramento area? Because several years ago, not that long ago, less than a decade ago, it was a lot more financially realistic to get into a home in Sacramento.
So I was just reading an article yesterday, and it was talking about how people are mass exodusing from California to Texas. What I focused in on was that the population for Sacramento year over year over the past 5 years actually has been increasing. The Sacramento region, almost 1.5% on average. And a lot of those folks are coming from guess where? The Bay Area. So they still want to be here in the area because we're 2 hours away from everything awesome. However, they don't want that Bay Area price. I believe the median sales price for a home in the Bay Area is $1.7 million, something ridiculous. So if you've got that in comparison to 510, this is the best place to be, especially if it keeps you closer to your job.
Adam, do you think that is a significant factor in the drivers of a high cost of housing coupled with the low capacity that we have in the state?
Oh, absolutely. I think Key really hit it on the head there. We do have folks leaving the state, but what we have are folks coming from the highest cost areas, which is the Bay Area and Los Angeles, moving into areas that used to be more affordable, like Sacramento and the surrounding regions, and then folks that used to live in Sacramento moving even further out or moving to places like Texas or Arizona and what have you. I do know in the Bay Area, for the median home, you have to make about 150% of the median income. And so when we have a disparity like that, it really makes it so folks like my family's been in Oakland for three generations, but me and my wife are the last folks that really live in Oakland. And that's really been because most of my family can't afford to stay there. And so they've been looking for more affordable places to live and, frankly, buy a home. Because just because you're a working class person, just because you don't have all the money in the world, still means you want to take care of your family. It still means you want to pass something along to your kids. And what we're seeing is Californians are willing to go further and further out to make sure that they can achieve that type of California dream, American dream, what have you. But what we're doing is just creating more and more competition for a limited amount of supply of housing.
At this point, is it still the best option to own a home to build wealth for your family?
I don't think there will ever be, well, never say never, but yes, yes. We just have to find ways. We have to be open to the ways necessary to make the path affordable for everyone. We just have to. We have to disassemble the foundation, the structure that our current system is built on because it is discriminating. As I was talking earlier about how these offers are accepted, the agents are still the gatekeepers. The sellers are... You have a choice when you are ready to sell your home. If you choose someone who looks like you, chances are that person is then going to use their same biases, their same lens when it comes to selecting an offer. And if we are not being intentional about acknowledging our biases, then we continue to get what we get. And so it's imperative that we create the opportunities to allow for those of us who cannot compete on that higher level financially to still access homeownership, and not just some type of basic homeownership, but homeownership that makes you feel good. Homeownership that is going to accumulate that wealth that we were promised many, many centuries ago, and that was taken away from us several times, if I could just say that.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we've been speaking with Key Matthews from Matthews & Company Realty Group and Adam Briones with California Community Builders about navigating the current housing market. So let's get to solutions, right? If someone wants to get into the housing market, they want to build equity, they want to build generational wealth, but it's really difficult for them to get in. I mean, how does your organization guide people into breaking into the housing market?
Well, first, they need to work with great professionals like Key. But one of the things that we think a lot about is this question of housing production. And so right now, we really have a binary. On the one hand, when we think about rental, we think about, you know, multifamily buildings, you know, 10 units to a building. But when we think for sale, we tend to only think about single family homes. So one home, one family. One of the things we're trying to do at California Community Builders is complicate that a little bit and really think about how we can elevate the concept of multifamily home ownership. So how can folks come together, you know, through a condo system with their families, with their friends, to basically own property together? So that way we're being more efficient with our land, we're being more efficient with our cities, and we're making it so that families can more naturally afford home ownership, make it so that it's lower cost. And I know today in the state of California, the average single family home is probably north of $750,000 median, but the average condo is around $550,000. So we really think that this is an area that needs a lot more work, a lot more support, and a lot more structure here in the state so that more families can achieve home ownership.
So essentially, you know, two people, I mean, because traditionally we think of people being married, you know, and then they buy a home. But you're saying two people just, you know, they could be family or friends. They go into a home together.
Right. And our new report on our website, ccbuilders.org, really talks about three categories. So one is just the market rate, which is, you know, condos and co-ops and what have you. Second is affordable. So that's below market rate condos. That's things like community land trusts. And then you have informal multifamily home ownership, which is exactly what you said, is it's, you know, me and my sister coming together, buying a home, splitting the maintenance costs, and then splitting the profits. And there's a lot of good, you know, history around people doing that, but there's not a lot of support here in the state right now to enable people to do that in a safe and structured way.
What are the challenges then that need to be overcome to overcome the challenges with support that doesn't currently exist?
First and foremost, our mortgage industry is not really well set up to have people come together and buy a house together. It's really meant for a single person or a married couple to buy a home. Just conceptually, that's how it tends to work in the market. And then second, right now, when people buy homes together, either through a condo HOA or just informally, you know, friends coming together to buy a home, the basic sense is that once that home is purchased, once the loans are closed, you know, people are sort of left on their own. And obviously, you know, things can go wrong in any real estate transaction. And when they go wrong in multifamily home ownership, they can go really wrong. And so I think that while we don't want to overregulate anything, we do want to make sure that people have the support and structure they need to make sure that their home ownership journey is going to be as safe and sure as possible.
Key, are you seeing this play out in your field?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. We were talking in the lobby because one of the things. So I've established this community called SAC Club 100 here locally. And what we are a group of real estate agents and lenders whose goal is to make sure that we are creating systems and processes to help everyone at every level of home ownership. And one of the phrases that I use is turning over every rock. So we have these learning labs once a month for individuals. And during this last learning lab, we discovered that there are people who are open to purchasing together. So literally, just less than a week ago, we've coined the phrase cooperative investment purchasing. Same concept, where a group of people come together because perhaps alone they only qualify for around $300,000, but together, two or three of them, now you're at $600,000 or $900,000. Now we can look at duplexes and triplexes and fourplexes. And then at the same time, they're able to afford these higher rates together. They're splitting all of these costs. And they're creating community together. A group of the ladies were in their 50s and 60s. And so just imagine being at that age and just having this built-in family as you do this. But as Adam was stating, there are pros and cons to it. So how do you hash this out? What loan programs do you use for this? And that's where we dismantle and recreate to make it work.
What other advice do you have for someone that just feels like they can't get into owning a home right now, but they really want to?
So, again, it goes back to this community that we've started. If you don't mind me throwing out my website here, our website is joinclub100.com, joinclub100.com. And the catchphrase is just have the conversation. Just have the conversation. You don't know where you are and where you need to be until you take a look at in a safe space with professionals who have your best interest at heart. No attachments. just let's look at what's going on and let's help you map out a plan to get to where you want to be, whether it takes 3 months, a year, or even longer. I had a client reach out to me in 2014 to buy a home. She just closed escrow 2 months ago, 62 years old, and she said she thought she would never buy a home. She hung in there. We stayed in touch over the years. It's one of my biggest success stories in the industry.
I would imagine that was an emotional moment as well.
Very.
It's almost a decade in the making.
Yeah. And she's in a beautiful community. Beautiful community.
Adam, when it comes to the state, what could the state do to better help make homeownership financially realistic?
I go back to this question of supply. Fundamentally, if we don't have enough homes for everybody that wants to live here, we're always going to have a high-cost market, and we're always going to be pitting Californians against one another as we bid for housing. So one of the things that California Community Builders is working on is how do we enable small lot development to happen in more communities? Like right now, I believe the median-sized lot of a home in California is about 8,000 square feet. In high-cost places like the Bay Area, like Los Angeles, like Sacramento, a significant portion of the value of your home is due just to where it's built. And so in a place like LA, about 60% of the value of your home actually just comes from the land underneath your house. Mm-hmm. So the more land that we make families buy, the more expensive their homes are going to be. And, you know, there's plenty of families that want a big lot. They want a big backyard. They want a big front yard, and they can afford it. And that's great for them. The market serves them. But the market does not serve well those families that would happily give up some yard space to just get into home ownership. And then second, and I think going back to what Key has brought up, we do need to just make it easier for people to come together to buy homes together. This idea of coming together with your neighbors or with your families to build wealth, to build community, to make it so that intergenerational families can stay together, can live together without having to exactly live together. You know, we just think that that concept is one where everybody wins. You know, folks, builders can build more, lenders can lend more, people can buy homes. And we just think that the state of California could be doing more to enable that. We think that the private market could be doing more to enable that. And we just think that that concept is something that needs a lot more attention and a lot more care.
Was there a time, I know if I can say for myself, I mean, there's a long time where I thought I wouldn't be able to afford a home. Did you always think owning a home was possible for you?
I actually bought a home right out the gate in 2004 when the market was crazy and everybody had a license. But my broker at the time said, Keisha, that's a lot of money for a house that small. And he was right. Ultimately, I ended up having to sell it. I actually wish I had held out and not sold it. I don't know how I could have done that, being in the industry without trying to work five different jobs. But I did end up having to sell it in a short sale. I was able to do that. But the lesson from that was there were people at the time who knew exactly where the chips were getting ready to fall, and they still allowed what was happening to happen. There should have been some safeguards and some, you know, things around that to protect those who were the most vulnerable, and there weren't. At the time, before the market crashed in Sacramento County, somewhere around 40%, in the low 40%, African Americans owned their homes. And after the crash, we were down to about 19%. So there are just some things that you know out the gate how to protect people, and you should. You have a duty and a responsibility to do that.
So what makes you optimistic that that won't happen again?
Because I am that person now who knows. And I pledge and vow to make sure that we hold people's hands from the beginning to the end, advise them properly. If it's not the right time, here's the reason why. And if it is the right time, here's why you should do it. I am practicing what I'm preaching.
Adam and Key, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Keisha Key Matthews is the owner of Matthews & Company Realty Group, as well as a radio talk show host of Selling Sacramento. Adam Briones is with California Community Builders, and they are discussing how to close the economic and racial homeownership gap. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Have some free time this summer? Looking for some good conversation, some learning opportunities? There is a program at Sac State University that offers older adults a free interactive space to learn about a wide variety of subjects. Some of them include learning about the history of Juneteenth, which is coming up this weekend, a deep dive into Little Richard and Black roots of rock and roll, and a look into Sacramento's historic Japantown and Chinatown, and those are just a few. The Renaissance Society of Sacramento is in partnership with Sac State, and they kicked off their summer series that's titled Celebrating Diversity, Telling Stories That Haven't Been Told, and it runs through July 28th. Joining us is Deborah Seiler and Dora Duggar. Deborah is the president of the Renaissance Society, and Dora is organizing the summer program series. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
So, Deborah, I want to start with you. What is the Renaissance Society of Sacramento?
Well, first of all, let me say that it is not about jousting in Sonoma County. The Renaissance Society was formed over 36 years ago by a couple of professors who were retiring, and they wanted to stay engaged in lifelong learning. And they were supported by then-President Donald Gerth, who actually contributed seed money to form the organization. And the Renaissance Society was born with four learning seminars at the beginning, and now we have grown to over hundreds of presentations every academic year.
Wow. What attracted you? What got you involved from the very beginning?
Well, I was involved because I retired from my career and my neighbor introduced me to Renaissance. I'd like to turn this over, though, to Dora, because Dora has a very interesting and compelling comment.
Hey, Dora, can we hear you? I think we're having some technical issues.
I hope.
Oh, we can hear you. Yeah, wonderful. Oh, yes, we
fantastic.
Can hear you. Oh,
fantastic.
Zoom. The best in kind of like the kinks of Zoom, right? That we've all been accustomed to. So, Dora, yeah, why don't you take the lead? What attracted you to the Renaissance Society? What do you want people to know about it?
You know, I've been a member for 2 years, and actually, because of COVID-19, I was looking for something to do, being that we were all stuck in the house, and someone had told me about the Renaissance Society a couple of years prior, and I thought, why don't I look into it? Now, one of the things I love about it is diverse classes and lectures they offer for just $100 a year, and you can take as many classes as you want. And now that COVID is sort of on the down, we can have in-person classes as well as Zoom classes. And I live kind of far from the campus, so the Zoom classes really work out for me a lot of the time. Let's see, what else? One of the things, the classes are so diverse, like the one I really appreciate and my grandkids enjoy, the fact that I learned how to use my iPhone and I don't have to go to them all the time. And also there's classes on growing native California plants in my yard. And there's one that I really, really took to heart personally, and it was about dementia. One of our close family members came down with it. So I was able to, with the class, see what he's going through and have an understanding. And there's one last class I'd just like to mention. It's Qigong, which I go into the campus to take that. It's really nice to have.
You just laid out such a wide variety of topics that are so important. They're tangible that you can apply to your everyday lives, including, you know, I mean, you mentioned, you know, being able to use a smartphone and using it to the best of its capabilities, but also something that touches so many families, dementia and memory loss and not knowing how to navigate that, because oftentimes there's not a handbook for it, right? And this class and these lectures kind of help with that guidance and navigating really difficult times, you know, in a family's life. You're now curating the summer program series, Dora. I mean, what's in store for this summer?
Well, actually, I'm just one of many. Thank you, Deborah. But there's a host of people collaborating to make this a great program. There's only eight of them, being that it's an eight-week summer program. But they start from, we just had one, the Native American Experience with Al Stripton. It was really, really wonderful. We have the Juneteenth program coming up this Friday. Now, being an African-American, I know very little about Juneteenth. So I'm very excited to listen to what Dr. Daryl Freeman has to say about that this Friday. And let's see.
Dora, we also have one of our members is Frank Martinez, who is a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel, and he's going to be moderating a panel on the experiences of people in the military, people of color in the military, going back descendants from World War I, descendants of military veterans from World War II, and how their own experiences in the military as people of color influenced them and their families.
Deborah, what goes into selecting these eight topics that are going to be taking place this summer? Because, you know, as Dora mentioned, there was a Native American history. We're going to be learning about Juneteenth. You mentioned a veterans panel. There's even a gospel choir, history of Sacramento's Chinatown and Japantown, as well as a Little Richard documentary, which sounds pretty cool. How do you narrow it down to these eight topics?
Well, it was really tough. There were a group of us, and we were really looking to reflect the diversity of the Sacramento community. We would like to expand our membership. We would like to increase the diversity of our own membership. And so we got to thinking, well, what would be appealing to people and what is appropriate for the Sacramento community? So, you know, we were looking to the Asian population, the Native American population, our African American population, and our Latinx populations. So we just came up with these things through our volunteers and through their connections with the community.
Are there requirements to participate in the classes?
No, not at all. And in fact, I'd like to emphasize that our classes are free. They are open to the public. They are on campus. They are recorded on Zoom. And there will be a recording after the event as well. So for people coming on campus, they'll be in Del Norte Hall, room 1004. And there is parking available for non-members who don't have a parking permit. The parking is $8 per day.
Dora, you know, given that you've been part of the Renaissance Society now for a couple years, you know, what does it mean to kind of see the level of engagement that you get from people who are participating? I know you started, you know, when things were remote, but that's changing now.
Actually, one of the things that I see is the excitement of those that are taking the classes and also the instructors that are volunteering their time. They're not getting paid to give these programs during the year. I'm speaking of the year classes that they offer. And I really enjoy that, being that they're so diverse. Now, one of the things that I have noticed is less minorities participating in these particular programs and also in our Renaissance Society. I'm looking to see that growth in the near future. We have a new president, Dr. Wood, at Sac State, and I'm really happy to see that and listen to what he has to say for the future. Yeah. And I really appreciate your interview last week with him. That was wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. I really enjoyed speaking with the incoming president. You know, finally, Deborah, I mean, it's not just a summer series for free adult classes. The Renaissance Society also does philanthropic work, you know, to help students in need on campus. And this is kind of a year-round thing. There's a fall schedule as well.
Absolutely, there's a fall schedule. Our motto is learn, connect, and share. And we've talked a little bit about the learn part in these presentations. We will have so many more in the fall. Our classes begin September 5th. We will have our catalog posted on August 14th. And we have an orientation and open house coming up on August 18th. So we invite members and non-members, certainly prospective members, to come out and visit us. But with respect to the connect portion, I'd like to emphasize that we have lots of opportunities for our members to connect with the Sac State students. This is very meaningful to our members. We have over 80 volunteers each semester who mentor students taking the gerontology courses, which is very fulfilling on both sides. And sometimes they form lifelong friendships as a result of those mentoring. We give up our aging bodies to the physical therapy department once a year, and they measure how well we can touch our toes and climb a flight of stairs and how often we can sit down and stand up in a chair and walk for 6 minutes. So things like that that are really fun. We also do ushering for the theater and dance performances. So we have wonderful opportunities to connect with the university. With respect to the share aspect, we give out each year 7 $3,000 scholarships to Sac State students. We have given out over $250,000 in scholarships through the history of our organization to Sac State students. And more recently, with the food insecurity for our mm-hmm. students on campus, these poor Sac State students, some of them are supporting families, siblings, children, and we collect over thousands of dollars for the food pantry.
Well, this was such a treat to learn about the Renaissance Society. Deborah Seiler and Dora Duggar are both with the Renaissance Society of Sacramento. We have more information if you want to get involved, and that is on our Insight page. And with that, that's Insight. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.